This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So, wow, we hit a lot today from, you know, it was putting your investment money into food.
Right.
To the Antichrist and the return of the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, but other than that, there's nothing on the show. Just a boring slog.
Yeah, just it's a really kind of a sloth kind of show that just moves very, very slowly. Today, man, we are covering it all. You don't want to miss a second of it. It comes up right after this. You know, it's rough. Facing the day ahead of you. And what makes it worse is knowing that as soon as you do face the day, you're going to start hurting. If you're living with pain, please get your life back. I'm here to tell you I understand firsthand what it's like, and I may have the answer for you. My hands were so bad, I could not use them anymore. Yesterday, I was back painting again. I haven't been painting for about 6 months. I was out painting again, and I can do it because my hands aren't feeling like they're crippled anymore. It's a daily supplement that helps your body fight pain by fighting inflammation, and its name is Relief Factor. It's 100% drug-free. Over a million people have tried Relief Factor's Quick Start Kit. 70% of them go on to order it again month after month. It helps reduce or eliminate the everyday aches and pains you're experiencing, and Relief Factor can help you feel better. See how Relief Factor can help you. Their three-week quick start kit, $19.95. ReliefFactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF. 800-4-RELIEF. ReliefFactor.com. When you feel the difference, you know it works.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Robert F. Kennedy announced today he is running for president as an independent.
He's changed his mind. He's one of us now.
RFK called for my execution.
Well, I called you a traitor.
The next time you see Glenn Beck lying to the American public.
I respect him as a man. I am not looking to sabotage him. I don't want him to be president. But that's not my decision. That's your decision.
Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you're a Blaze TV subscriber, you can get that now. It is it's ready for Blaze TV subscribers, and on Saturday it'll be everywhere.
It's a good trailer.
It's
a good trailer right there.
You know, I feel as though I let people down in a way, because it's such a weird paradox, because I did not come gunning for him, and that's what I wanted.
I think we should
to
use
do
that terminology with a Kennedy.
Ian Glenbeck is gunning for a Kennedy. Well, Joe Biden would be okay with that. I mean, there's no security on him. But
yeah,
I wanted so badly to just take him apart. And it's not, but I don't feel that's my job. My job is to just ask questions that people want to know and have a decent conversation with somebody.
Yeah, I think that's the, I mean, you're not going to go in there, and that's not what you do.
I've always said this. I cannot invite somebody into my own house and then set them on fire. It's not really good. But I did say to him, there were some things that you have said in the past that Glenn will address. And he, so he knew that I was going to be addressing a few things, but I don't know.
Yeah, you didn't ambush him.
No.
He knew what to expect.
You shouldn't do that with anybody.
I felt the same exact way about the Alex Jones interview.
That you did.
I wanted to go in there, you know, guns blazing, metaphorically speaking. But he was so nice. Yeah, I couldn't. I couldn't. I asked him the questions I wanted to ask him, I think, for the most part. But I, you know, I thought it was going to be confrontational. And it wasn't. Was it that way with RFK? It wasn't confrontational?
Yeah, because I asked him some things. First of all, I mean, I have great, tremendous respect for his dad. I think Bobby Kennedy was the good Kennedy. You don't think so, Pat?
Yeah, I mean, he probably, relatively speaking, yes.
Right. And
I think
and
it was
now,
Ted. I think Ted was the good
yeah.
one.
Yeah. And now JFK wouldn't even make it into the Republican Party, let alone the Democrats.
Yeah.
So we started talking on things like that, and he never gave solid answers. He would give, you know, very nice scenarios, nice things that he wanted to do, but I never felt like I really got an answer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I...
Were you able to at least, I think, you know, because obviously a lot of the people listening to this are going to be conservatives. They listen to your podcast. Were you able to at least illuminate some of his more liberal views? Because I feel like what's been odd about the RFK thing...
He kept saying, I still believe in... For instance, we talked about ESG. And do you believe in ESG? You believe that banks should be able to say what people can invest in and debanking people? And he said, what is that? And I said, ESG. He looked at me like, I can't imagine how, but I actually believe him that he didn't know what ESG was.
I mean, that's
and he said, I know.
Incomprehensible.
You can't be president if you don't know what that is. But I said, ESG. And he just kept looking at me. I said, environmental, social, and governance. And he said, oh, environmental. I'm still right where I was on environmental. And I said, no, do you believe? And he said, well, no, I don't believe that. So it was never, I just didn't feel like you could really pin him down. He kept coming back, however, to, you know, COVID changed everything for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether that did or not, I've always looked for turning points. I've looked for that pivot point in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
He claims that's his pivot point. Maybe it is.
You know, if you want to be president of the United States, I'd like to see a little setting time of the cake. You know, you take the cake out of the oven, maybe let it set a little bit before you eat it. And it's like, okay, like, this is a guy who argued for decades, by the way. And we have, you know, the one clip is in the trailer of him basically calling you a traitor for not having the same view as on global warming. That went on for decades after that clip where he was saying people like the Koch brothers should be put, they should go to The Hague. Mm-hmm. These are his quotes.
Mm.
Now, I am not completely stunned that after COVID, and he went through a lot of all of a sudden his views were out of line with what everyone liked, and all of a sudden he was feeling those pressures. I'm not surprised that would change his perspective. However, I'm a little skeptical of a person who believed that for that long of a time and only changes mind because it hurt him. That's not the type of principle I want in a leader of the country. Is he defending American values, or is he defending, wow, this thing happened to me and now I realize it's real?
He said, and you'll hear it and you can believe it or not by listening to him, you know, he said that it was not that it happened to him. It was that he did not expect the American people nor the government to actually do things like that.
You mean the things that he was advocating for for multiple decades?
So basically, he claimed it was hyperbolic.
And it probably was. I don't know.
When you just said, I want to go gunning for him.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't mean it that way. We would have never said that 20 years ago, 15 years ago. We all would have known.
Yeah.
We still do.
But, like, that's not...
I know.
That was
know.
Not what he was doing. I'm sorry. That was not a I'm joke not, based on a terrible incident in the Kennedy family history.
You're going to have to
He was advocating for
yourself.
A policy and did it for a long time in a lot of detail over multiple decades. Mm-hmm. That's like you being like, you know, I just...
just don't like capitalism anymore because that thing that happened last week made me president. Like, what? What? No. How about the, you know what? You set for the, you marinate in that opinion and wait for it to challenge you again. And let's see how hard you hold that line.
Well,
I'd be concerned. This is outside of who he is as a person and the things that I don't like about him. But it's like anybody, I think that that is a rational request. Like if a massive change in all of your opinions happened within the last presidential cycle, I don't know, maybe wait one more presidential cycle before you're the president. I don't know. That's a crazy line for me.
Well, he's going to. At least one, and probably many more.
Yes, he's not going to win.
He's not going to win.
It's a frustrating
thing. No, but, you know, he could affect Joe Biden. Yeah. Well, adversely. He was talking, you know, to Republicans.
I know.
I mean, he
claims
saying,
he was offered the VP job under Trump.
Yeah.
I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah.
He claims that happened.
Yeah. I actually walked away liking him, thinking he's when it comes to foreign policy, he's much smarter than I thought. We agreed on a lot of things. If you trust, I thought there were things that, you know, kind of overlapped that I ended up liking him, but I don't trust him. And that just comes, I think, from time, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. You know, I have no idea if that's real or not. I have no idea. And in today's world, I'm not willing to roll the dice. We're already rolling the dice with every candidate. Why roll the dice with this one? We know what Biden is going to do. He's proven it to us. We know what Donald Trump is going to do. He's proven it to us. I'd rather not try this one out on the Daytona 500.
Plus,
let's have him run a few laps elsewhere.
On the things on which we disagree vehemently, like climate change, like abortion. I mean, those are, sorry.
They're kind of two big ones, right?
Like really big ones.
Climate change is the control basically of the entire economy.
Yeah.
So that's a big one to disagree with somebody. On abortion, these are children that will either live or die.
Right.
So
that's kind of a big issue.
I don't know if you've heard, but in Arizona, the Republicans just can't get their act together.
I heard this morning on a podcast, and they were like, oh, well, the Republicans couldn't get their act together to overturn this law. And it's like, well, maybe the act they want to get together is not killing children. Maybe that's the act they're trying to accomplish.
Well, that came from 1864, though, and anything that comes from 1864 is bad.
Really,
inherently.
Like laws
just
like
bad.
That are not against, you know, if you go back. Mm-hmm. There were laws against murder in 1864.
That's a bad law. Then.
So we should all the laws now from 1864 we're just going to get rid of and see if we can repass. Is that what we're doing now?
It's asinine.
This is the law that was on the books. And like you guys could have passed a law that killed kill all the children you want law. That could have happened the entire time Roe versus Wade was in. You didn't do it. So you have the law that's on the books. That's the way that this works. It's just incredibly frustrating. And like, they just will get to this point where, I mean, we saw this with Bill Maher. Did you see this Bill Maher clip this week where he was talking about abortion?
Do we have it?
We have this? Okay.
Play the Bill Maher clip.
The idea that you're fighting an election around this issue seems to be, you know, just strange. Back to the 19th
life and
century.
That's weird.
Not if you believe it's murder.
Thank you.
You know, that's why I don't understand the 15-week thing. Or the Trump's plan is, let's leave it to the states. You mean, so killing babies is okay in some states? Mm-hmm. Like, I can respect the absolutist
laughing.
Position. I really can. I scold the left on when they say, oh, you know what? They just hate women, people who aren't pro-life, pro-choice. They don't hate women. They just made that up. They think it's murder. And it kind of is. I'm just okay with that. I am. I mean, there's 8 billion people in the world. I'm sorry, we won't miss you. That's my position on that.
What? Wow.
Even chilling to his audience.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not
is that not your
much.
Position if you're pro-choice?
Isn't that mainly because you don't like children? I mean,
yeah,
no,
exactly.
No. I mean, but
no,
if you are, you
honest.
Said you're pro-choice. That's your position too.
And he, by the way, nods to that, Piers Morgan, nods to that, yes, that is my position. That's just admitting it's saying the quiet part out loud, right?
Right. I'm okay with murder.
Yeah.
I'm okay with killing babies.
I think it's fascinating because comedians,
like their job is obviously to exaggerate and be funny. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really even trying to be funny.
No, not at all.
Comedians do this often where they cut the other part of their job is cutting through all the crap, right? Mm-hmm. Like pro-choice. What does that actually mean? And he's not the only comedian who's been doing this.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
When things go down in this world, a lot of time they go down very, very quickly. It's the old saying, when did you go bankrupt? How'd you go bankrupt? Well, slowly and then overnight. Things pile up and then all of a sudden something breaks the camel's back. And we're looking at those things every day. If you've been preparing for emergencies, you know you need emergency food. But a lot of people haven't prepared. Do you have enough food? I know it sounds crazy, but you and I know that it's not. Your supply should be within reach, ready to grab, go at a moment's notice, and you can secure those supplies at MyPatriotSupply.com. Start with a four-week emergency food kit. The thing provides over 2,000 calories every day. All the food is protected by heavy-duty four-layer packaging, will last up to 25 years in storage, and it's sealed inside rugged buckets with handles that you can grab if you're in a hurry. It's MyPatriotSupply.com. Get as many food kits as your family needs, $50 off each. They'll ship fast and free in unmarked boxes. Save $50 per kit at MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Now back to the podcast. Maura Nomdar is with us. She was in the Trump administration. And Maura, I've been following you. We've been looking at what should we be doing with Iran. I feel like we've passed so many exits and our government is only making things worse by cozying up to them. What should be happening? What should we be looking for and what should we be hoping for?
Hi, Glenn. It's a pleasure to be with you. And you're totally correct. You're absolutely correct. So what's happened now, all of the trouble that's happening in the region is a direct result of the head of the snake, as you very correctly said, which is Iran, right? So this is happening because the Iranian regime is not only deeply unpopular with their own population, they need to externalize conflict in order to stay in power. People that are familiar with the policy of President Trump know that his policy was exactly the worst nightmare for the regime, because right. He was using maximum pressure to cripple the regime by robbing them of the funds they use to spread terror at home and abroad, right? Mm-hmm. So this regime, when you understand the history of it, that it came into power in a whirlwind in 1979, it's based on terror and it's based on ruling through fear. And they had to externalize conflict in order to keep hold. So we would be remiss not to be students of history and actually understand that for this regime to maintain power, they have to externalize conflict and they have to create manufactured crisis for people to rally around the flag. It is a false enemy. The highest population of Jewish people outside of Israel in the Middle East are in Iran. There is no natural animosity between the Iranian people and the Israeli people or Jews in general. This is a manufactured crisis by the Islamic regime and power in Iran, and it's one of many that they need to try to distract and keep hold of power.
You know, it's one of the only countries that I look at a lot like we should have looked at Russia when it was the Soviet Union, that the people were not the government at all. And in fact, I think the United States, it's starting to be like that way now, that our government is doing things overseas and, you know, fighting wars and forcing people to live under our, you know, our quote values all over the world. And we're getting a bad name around the world. And it's like, no, but that's not us. That's the government. Same there. And exactly the same as it was in the Soviet Union. And that's different than most places. That's different than, for instance, in Gaza, where most of the people are, you know, they really do believe that, you know, the Israelis need to be killed and America is the great Satan, et cetera, et cetera.
So in Iran, the population is vastly pro-American, right? So you have a very pro-American population. And if you recall, prior to 1979, things like the hijab or the mandatory hair scarf were not around. So you have a population or, you know, an age group that's my age or younger that remembers, hey, their mom didn't have to do this. You know, their ancestors didn't have to do this. This is manufactured restrictions from this regime. So you have a very pro-Western, pro-American population. When the regime, you know, paints the American flag or the Israeli flag on the ground, the population will walk around it. This is a population that under President Trump, you know, was chanting his name, and people wrote Trump 2020 on IRGC bases. This is a very brave population that is very pro-American, that believes in the values of America, believes in the dream of America, and, you know, wants to emulate that. It's their regime that's counter to it. So if we don't understand that and we don't capitalize that as Americans, we're remiss and we're going to keep making the same mistakes. Why are we funding an anti-American regime through non-enforcement of sanctions, through, you know, these horrible hostage deals that you're just promoting the more taking of hostages, and then wondering why the policy is a failure? You know, had a working policy under President Trump, and Joe Biden completely reversed that policy back to a failed Obama-era JCPOA appeasement stature, and then we're wondering why it's not working. Well, let's have some strategic smart policy. You support the will of the people, and you put maximum pressure on the regime. Support the people that love you, and you put pressure on the people that hate you.
Okay, so what should, because I look at Israel and, you know, their response, which they say is coming, but probably, you know, after Passover. I look at this and I think to myself, as an American, oh, no, please, I don't want another thing on fire. But it's already on fire. But if I were as an Israeli, I would be saying, hit them right now. Hit them. What should they do if you're from the Israeli perspective? What should they do?
So from the Israeli perspective, they're between a rock and a hard place, right? It's impossible to fight on every single front. And of course, you know, when you're attacked, any country has the right to have a response. My point is, be strategic, because you cannot get into a war with Iran and expect a good result. And you don't even want to do that, not just because the U.S., you know, is under a certain type of leadership that is probably not going to, you know, help you out to the degree that you'd want to be helped out. But even beyond that, accepting the reality of what the situation is, why would you want to make an enemy of the Iranian people who are already on your side and re-solidify the regime, right? The regime, when it came into power in 79, was very unstable. It was the Iran-Iraq war and Saddam's invasion that allowed them to have people rally around the flag and solidify themselves through a power grab. Why would you repeat that mistake? If you want the end result of a peaceful, stable, democratic potential ally in an Iran that you can get along with, well, great. Let's take steps to make that happen. You know, dropping bombs in an all-out war on a population in Iran is not the way to do it.
But wait. I don't think that's what they would even consider. I hope not. But I think they would target strategic places that would hurt the administration and hurt their ability to build bombs.
Right. I think a strategic response is, you know, totally within their calculus to decide on what they want to do and not do. From my perspective, I think the less casualty or loss you have to innocent civilian lives, the better position you are, because the more that happens, as they've seen, the more of a PR nightmare it is for them and more of a nightmare it is on an international scale. So they've got to be strategic. They've got to be very, very careful about how they respond. But of course, everybody's entitled to respond whenever they're attacked.
So what are your thoughts about the long arm of Iran? I mean, we're seeing people now on the streets, you know, death to America, death to Israel. We're seeing things that we've not seen in our own streets, and we're seeing a lot of it. And I got to believe that when they're ready, they'll pull the trigger. When they feel it's the right time, they'll pull the trigger, and we'll have really not good things happening here.
Again, another Joe Biden policy failure, right, with his border crisis. So this is the absurdity of Joe Biden's administration and, you know, the failure of reversal of Trump's policies that were working. So this is a direct result of allowing an open border crisis and allowing anybody to come in without any vetting. I mean, I'm the child of immigrants, right? There's nobody, I think, that thinks that there shouldn't be any immigrants allowed in the United States. But you have to know who's coming in, what their intentions are. You have to have proper vetting. And you can't allow this type of infiltration of our country of nefarious actors, because the regime does have a long arm and they are sending people in. And, you know, it's been publicized in the press when I worked in the prior administration. They were trying to target administration officials back under President Trump, let alone what they're trying to do now. So, you know, there's former officials I work with that have, you know, pretty heavy full-time security. There's journalists that work for, you know, VOA and other stations that had pretty serious attempts on their life. So it's not a joke. And, you know, allowing this sort of open loophole to come in through, you know, any border, any entry, no questions asked, is going to be exploited by nefarious actors like the regime. And it's a crisis waiting to happen.
So does anybody in the State Department ever take the leadership's view of, you know, end of days and the 12th Imam and all of this crap? You know, they'll look at somebody who is, you know, saying a prayer, you know, someplace in America in a Christian church, and they'll be like, that's a religious zealot. They're going to tear the country apart. And then they'll dismiss these people who say in speeches, oh, Allah, you know, give me the strength to hasten the return of the promised one, which is really terrifying.
There's a big of cognitive dissonance here. And it's, you know, when you have discussions with people that, you know, might be working in departments and have a different point of view, there is a tendency to sort of say, oh, well, that's not what they mean, or that's hyperbole, or, you know, they don't really mean death to America when they say it.
Yeah, they do.
And it's just the sort of waving off that is just an unserious position to take. And it's not a secret that there's a lot of Iranian regime, pro-regime lobbyists in this country who purposely push this narrative and purposely provide false information to try to sort of wave off the crazy statements that are made and the really, you know, damaging statements that are made, and sort of say, oh, that's just hyperbole. That's just, you know, lost in translation. But it's really not. You know, I mean, the actions speak louder than words. And when the actions follow those words, you have to take them seriously. You can't just say, oh, it's a fluke 100 times over. Nah, they mean what they say.
It's really terrifying when you look at the history of Hamas and the Grand Mufti, you know, from the 1920s and 30s, that was a huge Hitler supporter, and what those seeds that were planted. And then in the new Islamic Republic, the leadership there, they mean it when they say, you know, we'll kill the Jews and, you know, Israel will burn in the flames of the Islamic fury. They mean that. They mean that. Do they, or?
I think that the regime knows exactly what they're doing to rattle everyone around them. And I think if given an opportunity to externalize a conflict, they'll do it. Right. So these are not irrational actors. These are rational actors who have a strategic point of view and believe what they believe. They use the foundations of, you know, whatever faith or political realities are necessary to achieve a political end. Right. So these people are not, you know, saying things that they don't mean. They mean them, and they want to be strategic to maintain control of power and maintain control of a population that is not supported by them, right? They're deeply, deeply unpopular with their own population, let alone externally. But they have to create a boogeyman. They have to create this externalized conflict to sort of distract from the plethora of problems they have at home. So, you know, you got to take them to a certain degree at face value, but also understand that there are political and strategic and real goals at the end of, you know, the pretty crazy statements.
You know, there doesn't seem to be any love of the Palestinian movement from the neighbors of Israel. They close their borders. They don't want them. And it seems to be the same thing with the administration of Iran. But the, you know, Middle Eastern countries, I think, like the conflict with the Palestinians. I don't know what it serves, but they seem to like it. They don't like Iran, but they seem to pussyfoot around. All of the advances that Trump made in pulling that coalition together, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and really building a coalition with Israel to stand against Iran, have we just blown that?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I can give you a nicer answer, but I mean, in a lot of ways, there's been a lot of damage done to a lot of the coalition building. I mean, the Abraham Accords were wildly successful. That was a great President Trump initiative. And frankly, I mean, talk about the Nobel Peace Prizes some years that have been handed out willy-nilly. President Trump should have gotten a Nobel Peace Prize for that, right? So that was groundbreaking for Middle East peace, is to have the Abraham Accords. And frankly, we're sitting in a position now where a lot of that work has been unwound and has been backtracked. And again, the United States needs to be a stable, reliable ally and a stable, reliable foe, an adversary for those that challenge us. Mm-hmm. You can't have this flip-flop of foreign policy from administration to administration. Yeah. And expect to have the credibility that we once did in the world, right? So there has to be, you know, some sort of adults in the room, which, you know, the Biden administration claimed to be, but clearly are not. And, you know, understanding that, hey, maybe we have policy differences with our predecessor, but these policies worked. And these policies were strategic and effective. And perhaps we shouldn't unwind them just for the sake of, you know, pacifying a base in the U.S. and saying we undid everything he did. You know, have some clear eyes and say that, hey, the Abraham Accords were a good thing. Stability in the Middle East and no new wars was a good thing. So let's keep that going.
Thank you so much for all that you do and making the Middle East a little easier to understand. More, I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Happy to.
God bless.
Happy to.
You bet.
Thank you. God bless.
Mora Nomdar, she is the former Assistant Secretary of State for Consular Affairs under Donald Trump. And a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
We have Bill Cloud back on. He is the founder of Jacob's Tent Fellowship, also Shorsham Ministries. And he's taught biblical prophecy for a long time. And what I like about him, he's not like, we're all going to die. It's coming tomorrow. He takes a very tempered look at everything and just can give you the facts that we know, but we don't know if those are the facts that, you know, God was telling us to look for. Is that a good explanation, Bill?
Well, I do try to be tempered. I mean, and I try to keep all of my theology in this solar system. So I try to be that way.
Okay.
And, you know,
And you said yesterday that sometimes, you know, what we think is going, we're looking for, is not necessarily going to happen the way we think it's going to happen. Can you give me an example of that?
Well, yeah, in Matthew chapter 17, Messiah goes up to the top of a mountain, Peter, James, and John. He's transfigured. His face is shining like the light. The disciples see this, and they're coming back down the mountain, and they're puzzled because they ask him, hey, we thought that the prophecy teachers of the day told us that Elijah would come first, but you're already here. You're obviously the Messiah, so how come Elijah didn't come first? And he said, well, Elijah did. You just missed it because you were looking for that Elijah, but you missed the whole message that John the Baptist was giving and the spirit and the power of Elijah. So that's a very quick example of we can be looking for this. It's got to look like that. It's got to be in this size and everything else. And the whole time God's doing exactly what he had said, just not in the way that we were looking for. So as I said yesterday, it's very important that as we read these prophecies, you know, we interpret them. We think they're going to happen this way based on what we see going on in the world today. But sometimes, and maybe even a lot of times, it doesn't happen the way we think. It just happens exactly the way God said. And it's usually after it's happened that we can look and say, oh, okay, yeah, I see it now. So that's an example. And that is very important, I believe, in going forward. And, you know, when we see all these things happening in the world.
So I often have thought if you were alive during Hitler's reign, especially if you were, you know, had a front row seat to it, you had to have thought Jesus is coming soon. But there were a lot of things that had not been accomplished. For instance, the reestablishment of Israel and then the gathering of Israel. And so, you know, if you knew your scriptures, you would go, well, no, I don't think so, but it could happen quickly. But now a lot of really big things have happened. What big prophecies have been fulfilled and what is still out there that we should be watching for?
Well, you mentioned the reestablishment of the nation of Israel in 48, the capturing of the old city and the reunification of Jerusalem in 67, which at that point gave Jews access to the Temple Mount, although temporarily. So the regathering of Israel is a big one, and I might say that one is still ongoing.
Yes.
And it has not yet come to its ultimate fruition.
And what does that mean? What does it mean, the gathering of or regathering of Israel? What does that mean exactly?
Well, very long story short, because of transgression, because of rebellion, because of all these different sins, Israel was exiled. And to this day, a lot of Israel is still scattered through the nations. And so there are these multiple prophecies of how in the last days God will gather all of Israel into the land, to the point, and this is the way Jeremiah puts it, that they will no longer talk about the exodus out of Egypt, but they'll talk about the exodus from all these different nations. And because we aren't talking in those terms just yet, that tells me it has not yet come to its ultimate fulfillment. Because right. we're going to talk about, in just a couple of days, how God brought his people out of Egypt. So it's an ongoing thing. But that's a really big one. But, you know, there are other things that are happening right now. I think the Gazan war is something that is very significant, because there are prophecies about Gaza, about the land of the Philistines. I think this war has the potential, I'm not going to make the prediction, but it has the potential to lead into other things. The attack the other night by Iran was said to be at least, you know, affiliated with, you know, what's going on in Gaza and these kinds of things. So there are things going on right now that do set the stage potentially for some things to happen. And that makes our day a little different right now.
You're saying that Gaza could turn into, what are you referring to?
Well, again, there are different prophecies about Gaza, how it's going to be, destroyed basically. But here is the thing that jumps out at me. It's the fact that Hamas has played such a big role. The Bible names Hamas by name. There are prophecies against Edom and Esau, and it says because of the Hamas that you've committed against your brother Jacob, which is translated violence, I'm going to deal with you. In Obadiah, it says because you committed Hamas against your brother Jacob, I'm going to deal with you. In Genesis, before the days of Noah leading up to the flood, it says that Hamas filled the earth. So I do not believe that is just some cosmic coincidence. That's God way before any of this, you know, we were even thought of. God's already telling us things in the beginning to be on the lookout in the end. So the fact that Hamas has been the instigator, the primary instigator, as it relates to what's going on in the Gazan war right now, to me is something that's very, very important. And that means then it has the potential to expand into other things, other prophecies. They talk about the destruction of Damascus and, you know, it leading all the way up to, you know, what a lot of people are looking for, the war of Gog and Magog. So all that is on the table as a possibility. Is it going to happen right now? Mm. Again, I don't know. There are things that are happening that could lead to these more dramatic events. So anyway, that's...
Well,
what I mean by the Gazan thing.
The destruction in Syria, Damascus could happen overnight. The return of the Jews to Israel, you would think that would be almost impossible. But, you know, one of the things I've been thinking lately, disconnected from, you know, end time stuff, is if I were a Jew today and I saw the whole world starting to heat up like this, there would come a time when I'd be like, I'm going to Israel, because I at least going to stand with my own people, because it's the only place where I may not be persecuted, you know, without a shot of standing up.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail, from accepting payments to managing inventory. Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Well, and I think that this is going to sound maybe a little bizarre, but God's way,
yes,
is to put pressure on people,
yes,
to move them into the place that he wants them to be.
Correct.
I mean, that's just the plain, simple fact. So I don't discount that at all. I think that as, you know, these things begin to unfold, it's going to become increasingly unpopular in the world to be Jewish, to be associated with Israel, to stand with Israel. But at the same time, you know, God uses that pressure to kind of put people in the position that he wants them to be, to kind of force his will. And it's always going to be for the best interests of his people. But it doesn't feel very good at the time when you're being subjected to all that pressure.
Do Iran and Russia and their alliance play a role in prophecy?
Well, a lot of people think so. I'm one of those. And based primarily on what you're reading, Ezekiel 38 and 9, this is the war I mentioned briefly a moment ago, the Gog war of Gog and Magog, right? And so if you read the prophecy, we don't have time to do that today, but if you think that Russia is the land of Magog, then I'd say yes. In fact, that prophecy talks about how this chief prince, this ruler over the land of Magog is going to come from the far north. Well, if you start in Israel and go north, if you go to the far north, you're in Russia. So it seems like that Russia would be involved. And, of course, the old Soviet Union was never a friend to Israel. It was always aligned with Israel's enemies. If I were Netanyahu, I wouldn't trust Putin as far as I can spit.
No.
So, you know, Russia is, you know, not a good guy in this regard. And then when you read that prophecy in Ezekiel 38:9, you'll see that among the Confederates, the first one is mentioned is Persia, which is,
Iran.
Of course, the ancient name for Iran. Just as kind of a sidebar here, interesting to me anyway, the name Iran, or the modern name Iran, is derived from the word Aryan. Maybe that should tell you something.
Yeah, I've always thought so. Before we get into the Ark of the Covenant, which I just find fascinating, you said that we need to watch out for Esau. Who's Esau in the Bible and in modern times?
Well, Esau, of course, was the older brother of Jacob. He's all red and hairy, and he's impulsive, and he's a hunter and all these kinds of things. And he has no regard for the birthright. He has no regard for the covenant that God made with Abraham. Jacob is the more temperate one. He values these things that are eternal. So when Jacob obtained the blessing of his father Isaac, Esau vowed to kill him. So as you read ahead into prophecy, you will see that even though the man Esau died, God still addresses Esau, also known as Edom, you know, centuries later, because of your hatred towards your brother, because of the Hamas you commit towards your brother. I'm going to deal with you in the end. And so to me today, Esau is epitomized in those people like Hamas, like Hezbollah. They have this ancient hatred, and that's the way it's termed in Ezekiel chapter 35. And I would even include, Glenn, within that mix, all of these people that are getting on the Golden Gate Bridge and stopping traffic and doing all these protests and standing outside New York University last night and, you know, chanting death to America in Dearborn, Michigan. Mm-hmm. I would include that in the people that are identified as Esau from a biblical point of view, not so much because they're descended from the man.
No, but because of their ancient
mindset,
their hatred, their unreasonable hatred.